Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon, and I just did this, and it didn't record, and I'm pressed for time, and I have to do it again, so I might rush it a little bit, but it'll all be there Sunday. Two tables of the law. If you look at Ten Commandments monuments, often you'll see four on one and six on the other, and that's because of the Protestant Reformation that, well, they were expecting the tables of the law to reflect Jesus' understanding of the law, which was common in his day. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the first tablet of the law. And the second, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. Now, your first neighbor and your most godlike neighbor are your parents. And so, because the commandments really come in a rather deliberate order, no other gods before me. Don't reduce me to representations from creation. Don't lift up my name upon a lie. Keep a weekly witness to the goal of creation, your Sabbath rest. Prioritize your love of neighbor to the most godlike neighbor, your father and your mother. Now, why are our parents godlike? Well, they created us. They brought us into being. They produced us physically. They code us culturally. They bestow upon us the first draft of God, authority, normativity, our picture of the world. If anything, modern psychology has validated this assumption with respect to them. The Heidelberg Catechism's take on this very much falls in line. What is God's will for us in the fifth commandment? That I honor, love, and be loyal to my father and my mother and all those in authority over me. That I submit myself with proper discipline to all their good teaching and discipline. Now, this might sound a little authoritarian, but very quickly it acknowledges that, well, it's not all fun and games, and parents are not all good, and not all good parents are all good either. And also that I be patient with their failings, because they will have failings. For through them, God chooses to rule over us, and God chose to form us. Now, it's very interesting because some people will balk at that last statement, but people on their way out the door of the Christian church will very quickly embrace karma. And I might add that this sowing and reaping that you'll find pretty commonly in the Bible, attributing to God things that happen, and this, again, if you watch my videos, gets into God number one and God number two. People will throw off Christianity and very quickly start to talk about karma. And, well, this is sort of a karmic idea of sowing and reaping with respect to, well, these are the parents God gave you. And that begins to make us wonder, do we feel comfortable with that? Do we like that? It might not have been optimal for all of us. Now, the commandment itself, according to many interpreters, is actually pretty straightforward. John Walton, in his Cultural Backgrounds commentary, makes this note. This verse has been subjected to many interpretations. Most ancient readers would have understood this as an admonition to care for one's elderly parents. There's no social security. There's no retirement home. Throughout traditional cultures all over the world, it was simply assumed that your retirement plan was to have children, and that when you're too old and infirm to work, they will take you into their home and they will feed you. In fact, many laws similar to this and other ancient codes stipulated just how much food one would owe their parents. This was quite simply the way the ancient world works. Even in the book of Acts, the food distribution going out to widows, well, that was the community taking care of their seniors. Now, the Apostle Paul makes a note that this is the first commandment that's given with a promise, and the promise is really quite reasonable. Honor your father and mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. What does that mean? Well, if you grow up watching your parents care for their parents, and you might very well decide, well, that's what you should do when you grow up. Remember, our parents are our most godlike parents in that we learn what is right from them. And so if you take care of your parents and your children watch you take care of your parents, odds are they'll take care of you. If you treat your parents like dirt, well, they might treat you like dirt. And so the Heidelberg Catechism says, be patient with them in their failings. And hopefully your children will be patient with them in with you and your failings. And this long living has, well, a lot to do with, well, getting to eat when you're old. Because again, in most of human history, there's no Social Security, there's no retirement, there's none of that. It's just your kids. Now, traditional cultures around the world work in this way. Your parents are your first neighbors. Your family is your first community. Caring for aged parents by the family is a marker of one's moral quality. My particular part of California has many people from Asia who come from much more traditional cultures than many of us Anglos. And guess what? They place a high mark on this, and they're frankly horrified sometimes at the way some of us from Europe or of European descent care for our parents. They would never allow a stranger to care for your parents. But we do that. But these family ties, these family bonds, these things go deep. We have a lot of sayings about it. Blood is thicker than water. Family is the most important. You'll hear again and again on Arrested Development. But how well does that importance really play out? And haven't we in the last couple of hundred years be ready to get rid of it? In fact, in many ways, kingdoms and empires have mitigated against family. Kingdoms and empires performed important tasks such as waging wars, building roads, constructing palaces, and for these purposes, kings taxed their people. But they were pretty reticent about intervening in things down in the weeds. Traditional agricultural economies had few surpluses with which to feed crowds of government officials, police, social workers, teachers, and doctors. Consequently, most rulers did not develop mass welfare systems, education systems, or healthcare systems. They left such matters to family. All this changed dramatically, Yuval Harari says, over the last two centuries. The Industrial Revolution gave the market immense new powers, provided the state with new means of communication and transportation, and placed at the government's disposal an army of clerks, teachers, policemen, and social workers. At first, the market and the state discovered their path blocked by traditional families and communities, like churches, with little love for their outside intervention. Parents and community elders were reluctant to let the younger generation be indoctrinated by nationalist educational systems, conscripted into armies, or turned into rootless urban proletariat. Over time, however, states and markets used their power to weaken the traditional bonds of family and community. The state sent its policemen to stop family vendettas and intervene in domestic disputes and replace them with court decisions. Family doesn't decide, the court decides. No, Ricky, you can't spank Lucy. The lawyer sent his hawkers to wipe out long-standing local traditions and replace them with ever-changing commercial fashions or laws. This was not enough. In order to really break the power of family and community, they needed the help of a fifth column. The state and market approached people with an offer they could not refuse. Become individuals, they said. Marry whomever you desire without asking permission from your parents or your church. Take up whatever job suits you, even if community elders frown or the church elders frown. Live however you wish, even if you cannot make it to every week to a family dinner or to your church service. You are no longer dependent on your family or your community. We, the state, and the market will take care of you instead. We will provide food, shelter, education, health, welfare, and employment, and we will provide pensions and insurance and protection. And most of us said, whew, glad to be liberated from all of those traditional norms. Romantic literature often represents the individual as someone caught in a struggle against state and the market. Nothing could be further from the truth. The state and the market are the mother and father of the individual, and the individual can survive only thanks to them. The market provides us work, insurance, and pension. If we want to study a profession, the government provides schools. If we want to open a business, the bank provides money. If we want to build a house, a construction company builds it, and the bank gives us a mortgage, in some cases subsidized or insured by the state. If violence flares up, the police protect us. If we are sick for a few days, our national health insurance takes care of us, or at least our employee health insurance. If we are deliberate, if we are debilitated for months, National Social Services steps in. If we need around-the-clock assistance, we can go to the market and hire a nurse, usually some stranger from another side of the world with traditional values, who takes care of us with the kind of devotion that we no longer expect from our children because we didn't raise them that way. If we have the means, we can spend our golden years at a senior citizen's home. The tax authorities treat us as individuals, do not expect us to pay the neighbor's taxes. The courts, too, see us as individuals and never punishes us for the crimes of our cousin. Surely Jesus is against this. Jesus seems awfully anti-family in some of these quotations. Large crowds traveling with Jesus and turning to them, he said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brother and sister, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple." Wow, that doesn't sound like honor your father and mother. Another disciple said to him, "Lord, let me go and bury my father." Now, the point wasn't that his father was dead and needed to be buried. The point was his father was old and needed to be cared for. And the man said, "Wait until my father passes, then I'll be your disciple." And Jesus says, "Let the dead bury their own dead." Well, that sounds harsh. On one occasion, an expert of the law asked him about, you know, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "Well, follow the commandments." How do you read them? "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself." Exactly what we started out saying here. Jesus says, "Do this and you will live." But he says, "Ah, who is my neighbor?" Seeking to justify himself. Jesus told him a story of a man going from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he was attacked by robbers, and he was stripped and beaten and left for dead. A priest from his own tribe saw him, went to the other side. A Levi from his own countrymen, this is his brother, goes to the other side and passes by. And then a Samaritan, a religious and political rival, saw the man, took pity on him, went to him, bandaged his wounds, poured oil and wine on him, put him on his own donkey, brought him to an inn to take care of him, and the next day gave the innkeeper 2 denarius and said, "Look after him, and when I return, I'll pay you, the nursing home guy, whatever it is." And so then he asked the inquirer, "Who was this man's neighbor?" "Well, the one who had mercy on him." And Jesus says, "Go and do likewise." Wait a minute, you're so harsh on the dude who wants to take care of his father, and now you're applauding this man who's taking care of a total stranger. Which side are you on, Jesus? Jesus does this fairly often. You have heard it said in the Sermon on the Mount. The Ten Commandments, Jesus is often twiddling with. He's living in a traditional society. Love, honor your elders. Care for them in old age. Certainly this is good. Failure to do so will have disastrous consequences for you, the Ten Commandments says. But now you've got empires and nation states intermediary, you know, getting involved in the family and, well, liberating people to be individuals and to do as they please, no longer dependent upon the broad and granular expectations of family. And Jesus seems in agreement. Ivan Illich was a former Roman Catholic priest who looked around and said, you know, all this institutionalization of education and elder care and medicine is a betrayal of the Christian message. We should be caring for people directly, not paying some low-skilled wage earner from the other end of the world to do it, because when we care for someone directly doing the dirty work, it changes us. Henry Nouwen was a very successful Roman Catholic priest and also an author, wrote many books that Protestants loved. Was a lecturer at Harvard, much in demand as a lecturer and a speaker. He was also a closeted gay man, which came out after his death. He leaves this very lucrative career that many pastors would aspire to have and very few actually have, and he spent the remaining years of his life caring for disabled adults. Why would he do that? He did it happily, and he said, "This is the most meaningful work of my life." Isn't that strange? Jesus, for having told this man, let the dead bury his own dead, when Jesus himself is dying on the cross, looks down at his mother and doesn't say, oh, mom, I don't have any attachment to you. Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby. And he said to her, woman, here is your son. And to the disciple, here is your mother. And from that time, this disciple took her into his home. Didn't say go find her a nursing home. So how to understand this Jesus and this commandment? Jesus seems to break a certain categorical essentialism. Politically right now, this is actually at the center of a lot of our cultural disputes. We're awash in demands for categorical essentialisms, demands that people's status be raised or lowered by race, sex, gender identity, ethnic hereditary. We're going to clump people into groups, and those categories are going to govern. So it seems Jesus, well, a lot of individualism comes because of Jesus. Jesus, in a sense, sort of breaks the ancient familial essentialism or a tribal essentialism. And, well, you can read about this in Tom Holland's book, Dominion, cover of which shows up in many of my videos and sermons. Jesus disrupts that with his discipleship demands and says, care for the stranger. I thought I only had to care for my family. That's the point of the Good Samaritan parable, isn't it? Jesus also disrupts it with radical humanism that has become so common to people they no longer recognize it as Christian. So then how should we apply this commandment when it seems Jesus had been muddying it? And I think actually the Heidelberg Catechism gets things quite right, that I should love, honor, and be loyal to my father and mother. They're my first neighbors. And they're my most godlike neighbors in some way. Maybe not godly, but at least godlike. They're my first draft. They taught me the world. They produced me, all of those things. That I submit myself with and to all those in authority over me. That I learn from my parents to respect authority. And hopefully my parents were worthy of respect. And when parents are not worthy of respect, these things get muddled with down the line, as modern psychology obviously knows. That I submit myself to them with proper discipline, to all their good teaching and discipline. And that I also be patient with them in their failings, because they might be godlike, but they're not necessarily godly. For through them God chooses to rule us and to form us and to make us, and that's true. This isn't somehow a nod to authoritarianism, but an understanding that each of us functions better in this world if we understand and can submit to authority. But our lives are messy and they're a muddle. John Van Donk has been on my channel a number of times. He visits Living Stones from time to time. And when I first had him on my channel, I had him tell his story. Now, many Dutchies in the U.S., Dutch immigrants, will brag about their parents or grandparents or ancestors hiding Jews because they want to be on the right side of history, and many did so nobly and rightly against Nazi aggression. John Van Donk doesn't have this story. His father drove truck for the Nazis, something that would be shameful. His father and his mother didn't stay together, and John wasn't fathered like he had hoped for from his father. And for John, that became a source of bitterness, and it's something he carried with him. And it impacted his image of God the Father, and it impacted his image of himself. And he had to live with that for a number of years, until another Roman Catholic priest with some funny ideas kind of helped John see something about fathering and see something about his father in heaven, that although there were lapses in John's biological father, John's father in heaven had managed to father him through many other men through his life, men who would step in and be a father to him and teach him fathering and teach him fatherhood. In fact, one little job that John has right now is he works for an organization that's called Pro Fathers, that encourages us to pay attention to the vital need that fathers are in our lives. Many of us recognize the role that mothers play, but fathers are sometimes in our current categorical essentialism a little bit shoved to the side. And so what this did for John Van Dunk is it taught him about, maybe my earthly father wasn't what I needed, but my father in heaven brought in much fathering to me, and I should learn from that. Our parents are godlike, and they ought to be honored. They might not be perfectly godly, and in some cases they're dramatically not godly, and we have to deal with that. And we should deal with that with patience and generosity, not only because of them, but also not to wound ourselves. Jesus, in fact, does come to liberate, and that's the theme of this entire series when we started at the beginning of Exodus and are going through the sermon on, or going through the Ten Commandments, because we need to be liberated from a lot, and the commandments are for our liberation, because sometimes the only way to be liberated from certain aspects of ourselves is to recognize other authorities. Jesus comes to liberate from categorical essentialisms that bind us generationally, liberates us from escapist statisms. Well, I'm just free, and I'm not bound to anyone because the state will take care of one. Or state escapism. Well, let the state do it, not me. And from limitations of our own stories, the failures of our fathers and mothers, and yet learning how to honor even parents who were not trustworthy, and even if they were generally trustworthy and they bestowed upon us a good first draft of many areas of our lives, then we give them the honor that they in fact deserve. But all of this comes with the ability to love not just our family, not just those in our tribe, not just like us, but to love the stranger as well. And all of this opens us up to stories that are painted on a much broader canvas, where our Heavenly Father fathers through our earthly fathers and mothers, and fathers through the limitations bound by this time frame, even over into the age to come.